A downturn in travel, layoffs in the energy industry, struggling small businesses, what's it add up to? The state of the state's finances coming up today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. Controller Glenn Hager delivers some grim news about the Texas budget to lawmakers, but there's a bit of a surprise, too. The news is not quite as bad as some feared. We'll talk with him next. Also, the after effects of COVID-19. Could they linger even after the pandemic is passed? What's known and isn't about longer-term health effects. And decades after they took off from Texas bases during World War II, the women with silver wings get overdue recognition. Their story and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us on this first day of the final month of 2020. Final month of 2020. Doesn't that sound good? Let's say it again in unison. As if when 2020 is behind us, things will be better, right? Now, there are plenty of reasons to believe 2021 will indeed be more pleasant than the annus horribilis we are just now concluding. The ongoing pandemic and its aftershocks, nonetheless, will be reverberating in Texas well into the new year and for some time beyond. Indeed, as members of the Texas legislature take their places under the Pink Dome in January, they will most certainly see that the pandemic has severely eroded the amount of financial flexibility they have, certainly compared to what they had when they wrapped up their last session in 2019. I mean, just think of it. Oil prices way down, travel sharply curbed, many hotels, bars, and restaurants in financial freefall, layoffs and furloughs in industries from retail to hospitality to energy and travel. One major question, of course, just how big a hit to Texas's bottom line. The person who must deliver the hard news to lawmakers did so yesterday, and today he joins us to share his reality check on the state of the state's finances. He is Texas State Controller Glenn Hager. Controller, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Glad to be with you today.
Through the course of this pandemic, you've been kind enough to join us with periodic updates on the financial condition of the state, and back in June, I believe I recall your office predicting a $4.6 billion shortfall. Pretty grim picture, actually. But at the time, you acknowledged this was unprecedented, of course, and it was hard to know just how bad things could turn out. How do your projections stand now?
As we've gone through the course of this year during the pandemic since the beginning of March and lower oil prices, we've continued to see decreases in revenues and state severance tax collections compared to the same time a year ago. As well as you mentioned in the intro, hotel, leisure, hospitality, those areas continue to be significantly impacted. But sales tax receipts, which is roughly about 60% of all the tax receipts for the state of Texas, have not been as negative as we anticipated. Now, they're still negative on a month-to-month basis compared to last year. However, they're not near as dire. And so when you take that into account, revenues have come in a little stronger than we anticipated, specifically sales tax. Also, state agencies were ordered to reduce their expenditures, so those savings, and then also some of the federal dollars we've received in the CARES packages, therefore those dollars can actually be swapped from some expenses that we're having in essentially state appropriations. Those three things combined, plus obviously we'll have some more expenses coming up in the next in this current two-year budget cycle, which to remind everybody ends August of next year. So all I'm talking about is the remainder of the current budget cycle of this last fiscal year is in a much better shape than we anticipated.
Why do you think that is? I mean, is it because, you mentioned that sales tax collection, and we know that that is really the largest part of the state budget, has not been hit quite as badly as expected. And in fact, back in July, I believe, sales tax collection, correct me if I'm wrong here, was up over the same month in 2019. And I'm curious why that was and what that says about the economic condition of the state.
Yeah, very good memory on that. I was going to bring that point up as you begin to ask this question, is that we saw one positive month, and that was back in July, which was actually economic activity of you and I going out and purchasing items in June. And in looking back, we were able to quickly identify and understand that part of that was because people got stimulus check dollars from the federal government. There was additional unemployment benefits, as well as there was paycheck protection from the federal government for businesses, those combined, plus people were spending an inordinate amount of money in and around their homes. So those people who were teleworking were either buying workout equipment, they were buying computer equipment, businesses were, and then people were doing home improvement projects because instead of doing vacations, they were doing staycations. And so therefore, we've continued to see two areas. Retail is one area that's stronger in sales tax collections, and then also online sales. So people have bought so much more online during this pandemic. Even though that was the trend, moving more online, it has really accelerated in the last 9 months. And thankfully, the legislature passed some legislation I'd asked them to last session to make an equal playing field. So those brick and mortar stores that are charging sales tax, those online have to collect it too. So therefore, it's an equal business playing field. And by doing that, the state is now collecting those online sales tax collections. And we originally thought it'd be about $500 million in a given year. And in actually the last 12 months, it was almost $1.3 billion. And so that has significantly helped.
That is an important point to make because, as you're pointing out, we had a sort of safety cushion because the legislature moved in the previous session to try to capture those out-of-state online retail sales, right?
That's right. If we did not, then things would actually be way worse than they are. And so $1.3 billion, and that's not just the state. Local governments also receive a portion of sales tax. So that means local governments across the state of Texas, all 1,700 roughly that receive a sales tax collection, have received an additional $300 million that they wouldn't have otherwise. Because if we hadn't, especially during the pandemic, as online purchases were going up, we would be behind the curve like some other states are. Mm-hmm. For me, at least an equal playing field again, both businesses are treated equally and fairly.
Well, now, when you appeared before the Legislative Budget Board yesterday, I know that there were a lot of lawmakers who wanted to know, okay, so what will I have to work with? How much of a shortfall, ultimately, once you do the calculations, what does that leave us with? Do you have a number for them yet? Do you know what the budget's gonna look like?
One thing I've been saying consistently in every speech, and I've given so many online speeches in the last month, every time I say one part is we need a couple more months of data, a couple more months of data. And I've been waiting for someone to say, hey, I heard you say that in March or April, and here we are in September, and you're still saying that. And the point is during a pandemic, there's a lot of uncertainty. And somebody last night, they were asking this exact question, and I said, I'm going to give the legislature that estimate come January 11, as I'm constitutionally required, the day before session. I have no doubt that I will give an update to them during session because every couple of months is really critical because nothing like this has ever occurred. And that one person chuckled and said, wait, you mean the things that happened in 1917, that pandemic didn't give you enough information for today's world? And obviously the world has changed, just the point. And so, you know, every couple of months is really critical to give us a little bit better data points to understand what is going to be the impact. Next budget cycle is going to be a tough budget cycle, but to what level we just don't know yet, David. But I've got a little less than a month to give them an exact number, and we're working on those finishing touches right now.
Safe to say historic, right?
Very historic. Have never seen anything like this, and hope that we never see anything like it again. As you said in the intro, I can't believe it's in December. I've been waiting for this year to get over with, but unfortunately, we have a few more months in 2021 to get through this.
All right. Well, you know, listeners frequently say, well, come on. I mean, Texas has prepared for just this sort of unknown. It goes by the informal name of the Rainy Day Fund. You refer to it in your formal presentations as the Economic Stabilization Fund. Why not hit that up to make up for any shortfall we might encounter?
And that's one tool in the toolbox the legislature has, and we're very blessed to have it. Texas entered into this pandemic in a stronger footing than many other states and many other countries, which were in a much better shape. And also, as you mentioned, we have the state savings account, which at the end of this current fiscal year, which again ends August of next year, will have roughly about $9 billion in that account. So that's a very healthy tool in the toolbox to help the legislature, whatever that that fiscal hurdle they have come next legislative session. And hopefully, if we all continue to do our part, you know, obviously we all have to go about our lives a little bit different and continue to gauge in the economy. The economy hopefully will continue to grow a little bit faster than we've anticipated, which is good news for everybody.
Let me ask you about something, because you talked about the importance of capturing those online taxes. Okay, so if we're looking at this new legislative session, there are other potential revenue streams. Many states have turned to things like cannabis. Many states have looked at gambling. There are the so-called vice taxes, that kind of thing. We don't have an income tax here in Texas. Should we be looking to capture some of these sorts of revenue streams now?
Well, one, I'll say I don't think we'll ever have an income tax here in the state of Texas. Not only would the legislature have to vote for it as a constitutional amendment, and I don't think that's going to happen here in Texas. And also, that's one of the attractants, not having it, is for Texas to continue to grow economically, and that's one of the main reasons. Number two, as far as the other issues, you know, the legislature has been talking about potential expansion of gambling for 30 years, and they'll continue to talk about it. Cannabis has been talked about lately. One of the biggest hurdles and issues with that, not only do we want to have that in Texas, but that's a cash economy, and so there's no banking. So from an enforcement standpoint, it's very difficult to ensure that you enforce and collect those dollars because it's not in the banking system. And so, you know, each of those have significant hurdles, but, you know, the fact is the legislature, I have no doubt, will talk about it, and we're happy to play a role in whatever they're looking at to try to come up with some estimates of what dollars those may be, as well as some of the unintended potential consequences and costs that may come as well.
Glenn Hager is the Texas State Controller. He just delivered his message on the state of the state's economy to the Legislative Budget Board yesterday. Controller, thanks for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on The Standard today.
Always good to be with you.
All right, let's find out what Texans are talking about on this Tuesday in for Wells Dunbar. It's Texas Standard's own Michael Marks. Howdy, Michael.
Hey, David. We just heard about how the state's fiscal situation may not be quite as bad as many anticipated. The state's COVID-19 situation, however, just keeps getting worse. Yesterday, nearly 9,000 people in Texas hospitals who tested positive for COVID. That's the most since August. We'll hear more about this later in the show, but wanted to note that the White House Coronavirus Task Force asked the state to intensify its efforts to stop the spread of the virus. Lots of folks on social media calling for the same thing. Twitter user MixSome1 in Fort Worth writes, "Lockdowns hit the economy hard, yes, but in the U.S. we're seeing unimaginable catastrophic rises in cases, hospitalizations, and deaths due to coronavirus. It's past time we implement lockdowns again." Also in Houston, Giselle Gutierrez gives us this reminder. "If you traveled over the Thanksgiving holiday, top U.S. officials say you should get tested for coronavirus. The window to do that is open now."
Yeah, Michael Marks continues to monitor what Texans are talking about, and it seems like the pandemic, of course, still top of mind. We'd love to hear from you. Look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice.
Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com. Available in the dairy aisle.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. In Houston, there's a clinic for people who used to have COVID-19. It was needed because some people still have symptoms months after their initial infection. Houston Public Media's Sarah Willa Ernst reports on the health impacts of COVID-19 and what may linger even after the pandemic has passed.
Donna Kim Murphy is an incredibly high-functioning person. She lives just south of Houston in Pearland, where she's a neurologist, a community organizer, and a mom.
There were periods in my life where I could go 3 months sleeping like 30 minutes.
When she got COVID-19 in March, she experienced all the traditional symptoms: nausea, shortness of breath, and mild chest pain. She recovered from the initial infection, but struggled multitasking with the same ease as before.
Maybe I was about 85% my cognitive baseline at the same time. It was still like highly functional.
But in late July, things began to change. On and off, she would experience forgetfulness.
3 times in like the last 2 months, I have left the refrigerator or the freezer door open. And I do not do that.
as well as fatigue and depression.
I'm typically a very energetic and optimistic person. And in this period, I got super depressed very suddenly. I was kind of passively suicidal, like not really wanting to be here anymore. That's very uncharacteristic for me.
In some ways, she just didn't feel like herself anymore. She wasn't able to perform at the same level, and her sense of self-worth was in flux. Murphy is what many are calling COVID-19 long haulers, individuals who are dealing with symptoms many months later, like coughing and shortness of breath, the result of lung damage, but also neurological, cognitive, and psychiatric effects. Dr. H. Alex Choi is a critical care neurologist at the post-COVID-19 clinic at UT Health, which studies and treats long-term symptoms. He says it's been difficult for some patients to return to their normal lives.
I don't know exactly how many people, but I would say a significant number of patients ended up not being able to go back to work.
The clinic followed up with 50 patients in the Houston area 3 months after being hospitalized. The early study, which has not yet been peer-reviewed, showed that the majority, 70%, still had neurological symptoms. 42% reported fatigue, and about a third had PTSD. And it wasn't just severe patients.
I actually think people who have mild symptoms can still have these prolonged neurocognitive symptoms that can last for, you know, at least 3 months, but I think we're seeing it out to 6 months, and potentially it can be a year or two.
He says mild hospitalization doesn't typically cause PTSD.
But I think COVID is a very different type of phenomena. They're in rooms by themselves. Often they're not allowed to have visitors. People generally don't go into the room, so they're by themselves in almost social isolation in this hospital bed, wondering what's going to happen to them.
As for cognitive symptoms, some doctors believe it's due to an overreaction of the immune system, which can cause
not only inflammation in the lungs, but also causes inflammation in the brain.
UT Health is recruiting patients for a clinical trial on a potential treatment preventing long-term symptoms.
We're hypothesizing that when we decrease the amount of overinflammation, that we're going to be able to decrease some of the brain injury that can happen after COVID-19.
But that is only one hypothesis scientists are considering.
There will be a need for more research and I think resources for people who are basically disabled.
That's Donna Kim Murphy again, the neurologist and COVID long hauler.
I think that there is no question that there will be at least hundreds of thousands of people who are impacted, at least in the United States.
She's been talking with some of them in online communities, which she says really helps. I'm Sarah Willa Ernst in Houston.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with Texans who are working safe and keeping communities strong. More at texasmutual.com/on the job.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. A scathing state government report says the agency providing oversight for Texas law enforcement operations isn't doing a very good job. According to the Houston Chronicle, a recently released report by the Texas Legislature's Sunset Advisory Commission notes the Texas Commission on Law Enforcement's inability to adequately train officers and keep so-called bad apples out of the law enforcement job pipeline. St. John Barnett-Smith covers public safety for the Houston Chronicle, and he joins us now. St. John, welcome back to the Standard.
Pleasure to be here.
Your story begins with a rather stunning finding. Last year, more than 600 Texas law enforcement officers got a dishonorable discharge from their agencies for misconduct, yet more than a quarter of them were rehired to work as sworn law enforcement officers. I think a lot of listeners may wonder, how's that possible, especially given all the attention that has been focused on police abuses of power, certainly over the past year? Isn't the Texas Commission on Law Enforcement supposed to prevent the rehiring of so-called bad apples?
I mean, in theory, you're absolutely right. The problem is that, you know, this report found is that the TCOL, as it's called, just doesn't really have the powers it needs to do that kind of thing.
When you say it doesn't have the power, you mean statutorily it doesn't? Or are there other things within the law enforcement system, if you will, that prevent this agency from doing its job?
Both, actually. So the TCOL is only allowed to revoke officers' licenses in very rare circumstances, which include like a criminal conviction, failing to finish some training requirements every year, and maybe like one or two other situations. But then at the same time, right, it doesn't have the staffing it needs or the funding, and you have this other situation where police officers enjoy a really wide range of protections through the state law. You know, David, I think it's also really important to note that, you know, there are dozens of these post boards across the country, and a lot of them have a lot more power than Texas's. And you'll see, you know, in some of those places, you know, they decertify hundreds of police officers every year. So this can work in other places.
Let's talk about qualifications here. I didn't realize that to qualify for a peace officer license, Texas cops, as you write, need fewer hours of basic training than licensed cosmetologists and less than half the education that's required of air conditioning and refrigeration contractors. Is that something that this commission, this Texas commission that oversees law enforcement, is supposed to be policing? Does it provide the standards, or is that out of their control?
It's supposed to make sure officers complete that training, but they do not set, as far as I believe, they don't set the number of hours officers must receive. That comes through the basic peace officer course, and I believe that is mandated through state legislature.
So in part, that would explain why this report suggests that the regulation of law enforcement, and I quote here, is by and large toothless, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So what happens now? I mean, what was the purpose of having this report prepared, and what is the next shoe to drop, if one is to drop?
Every 10 years, the Sunset Commission, or about every 10 years, the Sunset Commission reviews different state agencies. And so they issued, the Sunset Advisory Commission issued a set of recommendations calling for basically a blue ribbon commission to look at this thing and provide a complete overhaul. That would, of course, have to go through the ledge. Whether or not that happens in this situation right now, where you've got a pandemic, where it's hard to have any basic kinds of meetings together, and where you have, a slew of conservative politicians who are kind of running against this idea of bulking up police oversight, is just remains to be seen.
Read all about it in the Houston Chronicle. That's where Sinjin Barnard Smith covers public safety. We'll have a link at texasstandard.org. Sinjin, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on The Standard. We certainly do appreciate it.
Sure thing.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, helping eligible Texans with disabilities save and plan for the future to pay for qualified disability expenses with a tax-advantaged ABLE account. Learn more at texasable.org.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Lauren Terrazas. The White House Coronavirus Task Force says there's a full resurgence of COVID-19 in Texas. According to the Houston Chronicle, the task force recommends that the state intensify its mitigation efforts. The report, which was released on November 22nd, finds more than half of the state's counties have high levels of community transmission. Governor Greg Abbott has repeatedly said he will not issue another statewide lockdown despite rising cases and hospitalizations. One of the areas in Texas seeing COVID-19-related hospitalizations increase is Laredo. More than 28% of the patients in Laredo's trauma service area have the coronavirus. That's the fourth highest rate among the state's 22 hospital regions. Laredo Health Authority Dr. Victor Trevino says all local hospital units are at or near capacity.
If this trend continues for safety reasons and the contagious nature of the virus, this hospitals may need to start asking patients after they triage to wait in their vehicles to avoid overcrowding in the emergency rooms.
COVID-19 patients exceed 15% of all hospitalizations in more than half of the state's trauma service areas. Texas is expected to have a backlog of 10,000 jury trials next year as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. David Slayton is the administrative director of the courts for the state of Texas. He says while virtual jury trials are allowed, there have only been a limited number.
Certainly some of them can really only be done well in person. And so that is an exception where we're likely to see a backlog of cases now and in the future.
While there have been few virtual jury trials in Texas since late March, there have been over 760,000 remote court hearings with more than 2.3 million participants. The Austin Police Department is facing another lawsuit over its use of so-called less lethal rounds. As KUT's Andrew Weber reports, it's the sixth one filed in federal court over officers' use of force during protests this summer.
In a federal complaint filed last week, Ariana Chavez says an unidentified officer shot her in the back of the head with a, quote, dangerous projectile, end quote, which caused a concussion and a serious head wound. Chavez was at a protest over the police killings of George Floyd and Mike Ramos. The Austin Police Department is facing a slew of lawsuits over less lethal rounds. Those include so-called beanbag rounds, which are birdshot-filled bags fired from a shotgun, and foam baton rounds, which are 40-millimeter shells tipped with foam. APD vowed not to use the rounds against crowds after two protesters were severely injured in May. The department has purchased thousands more since then.
Andrew Weber reporting. I'm Lauren Terrazas for the Texas Standard.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Last week, Texas lost a crusader for farm workers' rights. Genoveva Puga died in Alamo, Texas at the age of 92. What largely sparked her fight for justice was the tragic death of her son Juan Torres in 1977 when he was killed by machinery while loading crates of oranges for the Donna Fruit Company. To tell us more about Genoveva Puga and the life she lived is Rebecca Flores. She is former director of the United Farm Workers in Texas. Rebecca, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for doing this for Mrs. Puga.
I want to go back to that fateful day in 1977. I understand that you were head of the United Farm Workers in Texas at the time when Genoveva's son was killed. What do you remember?
Well, we remember the fact that he was killed, but pretty much after the fact. You know, at that time, very little reporting was done on deaths of farm workers. And so it was only after some digging and finding out from people who worked in the fields that this had happened that we became informed about it. And then, of course, Genoveva was migrating at that time. And so she didn't know anything about it. I mean, she knew that he was killed, but she didn't know the details until she came back. And that was a situation, I think. And of course, you know, he was undocumented also. So at that time, you know, reporting wasn't very concerned about what was happening to people in the fields.
I want to go back, though, to a painful picture that was taken at the time of Genoveva kneeling by her son's grave in a pauper's cemetery because she couldn't afford to bury him. It's not soon after that when she decides to take her fight to the courts, as I understand it. What were the specific things she was demanding?
Well, she really wanted to get to the bottom of how he was killed, right? How he was killed and left abandoned there and then abandoned by the company that had employed him. And she was outraged, like all of us were at the time, is that this company that had employed him really to do the work out in those orchards had said, well, sorry, you know, he had no connection to this company, and they tried to get away from having to pay any kind of workers' compensation or compensate the family for his death. I don't know what she felt, but it was an insult. This man who died there by himself, they didn't find him for some period of time. And then the company pretty much washed his hands of him.
This was a seminal battle, though. I mean, if you think about history and the outcome here, tell us a little bit about what happened as a result of her fight.
Well, you know, the fact that she had the gumption, because frankly, farm workers have always been so marginalized. In for all of history, really, farm workers have been excluded from anything and everything. We had no protections. We had absolutely nothing. And when we worked in the fields, we just said, well, whatever happens, happens to us, because this is our lot in life. And so she had, little as she was, she's a tiny little woman. Little as she was, she decided she wasn't going to do it, which I give her great credit.
As a result of what she did, what changed?
Well, listen, her lawsuit started the chain of actions and reactions that we put together as a union to try to force legislation that would cover farm workers who were hurt in the fields. And so he died in 77. She filed a lawsuit, I don't know, a year later maybe. And then we started doing a lot of organizing, political organizing, with a membership of the union to get farm workers covered by workers' compensation. That took from 77 when Mr. Torres died. We passed the legislation in 1984. It took us 7 years to get all of that done.
What do you hope is remembered of her by the next generation of migrant workers and labor rights activists?
I think that what we need to remember is that one person can do so much. One person can start a movement, which is really what she did. She started a movement to make sure that workers were protected. Workers who gave their backs and their arms, you know, to agriculture had at least some protection while they were working in the fields. And that's what I want people to remember, is that one person can do so much. And she was that one person.
We've been talking with Rebecca Flores, who is former director of the United Farm Workers in Texas. And we've been speaking about Genoveva Puga, who died in Alamo, Texas at the age of 92 last week. Ms. Flores, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on The Standard.
Thank you so much for doing this, too.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a statewide network that has been caring for Texans for more than 30 years. More than 55 physicians in the Austin area treat 26,000 cancer patients each year. More at texasoncology.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. For 25-plus years, Catherine Sharp Landeck has been completely enamored with the story of the women pilots of World War II. Landeck, a pilot herself and professor of history at Texas Women's University in Denton, recently released a book which focuses on the personal stories of the women with silver wings. In it, she follows these women from before the U.S. entered the war until Congress's decision to offer those women pilots the nation's highest civilian honor. Professor Landeck, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What was it that first got sort of piqued your interest in these women pilots of World War II?
You know, I went to an air show in 1993, and I met one of them just by pure chance. And I'd never heard of them. I couldn't believe it. I had a degree in history and worked at a flight school up in Tulsa and had never heard of these women who flew for the Army Air Forces in World War II, and just kind of decided that was wrong, and I was stubborn enough to spend the rest of my life learning about them so I could tell their story.
You know, it's interesting. There are multiple characters in this book, but, you know, Texas sort of seems to have its own special role here, almost a character itself, because you think of the many airports where these women trained, some of these pilots being Texans themselves, even the first woman pilot being killed in Texas, her name Cornelia Fort. Could you tell us a little bit about her?
Sure. Cornelia Fort, you know, she survived Pearl Harbor. She was in the air the day that the Japanese attacked, and she came back to the mainland to serve and was tragically killed in an accident, an air-to-air accident near Sweetwater, Texas, where other women were training.
Her story also, in a sense, highlights one of the many inequalities that those women pilots faced in World War II. Benefits after death, right?
Yeah, that's right. You know, so these women were brought in. It was a sort of experiment to see if women could do this. So they were initially brought in as civilians. So when she was killed, her family just got the $250 civil service death benefit, where if an Army pilot had been killed in the same way, they would have gotten $10,000. The 38 WASP who were killed during the war did not get the same recognition as they would have if they'd been brought into the Army Air Forces proper.
You mentioned WASPs. I think more people are familiar with the term WAC, Women's Army Corps. Tell us a little bit about the WASPs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the WASP, the Women Air Force Service Pilots, they were separate from the WAC. Only 1,102 actually passed and were able to wear those silver wings. But they were treated by the Army Air Forces as members of the Army Air Forces in every way, except, of course, for recognition and benefits.
The contribution of women has often been sort of stereotyped with the Rosie the Riveter cliche, mm-hmm. I suppose. And I'm wondering when, you know, you were writing these stories about these women who took to the skies, how much of a sense did you get from those stories about what motivated them to step into an airplane to serve their country?
Yeah, well, these women, they all came of age in that golden age of aviation. You know, Amelia Earhart was their hero kind of thing. They saw this opportunity to serve their country. You know, everybody wanted to do their part for the war. I remember one woman told me, well, I wanted to help with the war and I couldn't knit, so I joined the Air Force.
I want to ask you about, you recount a speech to an incoming class of female pilots given by U.S. Army Air Corps Lieutenant Alfred Fleischman, who told the women, you're part of an experiment that will do more to advance the cause of equality for women than anything that has been done so far. But you note this excluded, by and large, black women and Latinas, even though some were already serving in the military. Why did you want to focus on that issue in that portion of the book?
Well, I think it's really important to recognize that there were qualified women pilots that were left out. It speaks to the times, but it also speaks to the limits that the leaders of this program were willing to push the experiment. Jackie Cochran, who was one of the two leaders of the program, said, we pushed so hard to get women into these airplanes, and it would have just been too much to push to desegregate the group as well. You know, there were women who trained with the Tuskegee Airmen. I've found the names of six black women who applied to this program and were turned down specifically because of their color. I think it was one of those missed opportunities in history when they really could have gone a step further and showed that not only women could fly, but women of color could fly.
It was 2009 when Congress got around to offering these women pilots the Congressional Gold Medal. Could you give us a sense of the sorts of acts of heroism that Congress was trying to acknowledge for these women?
First, it recognized those 38 who were killed. The work that these women did, you know, whether it was towing a target behind their plane so men on the ground could shoot at them with live ammunition. Many of the ferry pilots would be the first pilots to fly planes to prove to the men that it was safe. You know, basically anything that the Army Air Forces asked them to do, they did, and got none of that recognition.
Do you think that there was a reluctance to do that because, say, men had served in combat and these women had not? Or what do you think was the rationale there?
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair question, but I think it's important to recognize that only 10% of the men who served actually served in combat in World War II. 90% of those who served during the war were support personnel. I think we forget that, and those men who served as clerks and those types of things got the recognition.
It's a very intimate book. I mean, you take special note of the colors of someone's hair ribbons, the smell of a meal that they shared. You had to earn that intimacy, it seems to me. You spent something like, well, more than two decades with these pilots, as I understand it.
Yeah. I appreciate you noting that. It was such a privilege to get to spend time with them, and they wrote letters home, and they wrote in their diaries. You know, they didn't have cameras as often as we do today, and Texas Woman's University is the home of the WASP archive. So that was really the great gift, besides just getting to be friends with these amazing women.
I feel like we've flown in a perfect circle, or maybe it's a figure eight here, because you mentioned that Texas Woman's University in Denton is home of the WASP, you know, archives. Could you talk a little bit more about Texas's role in the air and that part of the air war?
Yeah, and you're quite right. This is a distinctly Texas story. The initial training program started in Houston, and then they move out of Houston after being there for several months and realizing, you know, it's just too foggy. The weather's not great for training. They move out to Sweetwater, and it was just a distinctly Texas experience. You know, they'd go out to the ranches and ride horses. Of course, there's a museum there to the Wasp in Sweetwater. And so when the Wasp talk about Texas, they know it. And it's definitely, as you say, a lead character in the story of these women pilots.
Catherine Landeck teaches history at Texas Women's University in Denton. Her new book is called The Women with Silver Wings. Professor, thanks so much for taking some time to speak with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, presenting the Intersect Ed Podcast, where the stories of Texas public education policy and practice meet. Available at raiseyourhandtexas.org/podcast and most podcast platforms.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. COVID-19 cases are spiking in parts of Texas. El Paso, Amarillo, and Lubbock are hot spots, but far from the only ones. Health officials blame the increase in cases on smaller gatherings as people get tired of social distancing. KERA's Saida Hassan reports on growing concerns about what some are calling pandemic fatigue.
Dallas resident Kate Mackley can't bring herself to delete her mother's number.
You know, she's still in my phone's favorites. You know, she's right there at the top of the list, even though clearly that phone number doesn't work anymore. And clearly she's not going to answer it.
Mackley's mother, Carla, died of COVID-19 in April. She lived at Monticello West, a long-term care facility in Dallas where many residents tested positive early on in the pandemic.
The strangest thing was having her funeral over Zoom.
Mackley remembers how odd it was to end the video call that day without the comforting presence of loved ones or the rituals of an in-person funeral. It felt like the grieving process was cut short.
Not only do we still have this, you know, digital ghost that stays with us after we pass, but now, you know, our grieving has even become digital and, you know, secondhand. It's very strange.
Losing her mother early on in the pandemic drove home the danger of the virus. It's been months since Mackley has gotten together with close friends or seen some of her extended family. She understands that people are having a hard time staying apart after months of isolation. She is too.
I'm getting to the point of like, oh, I just don't want to limit what I'm doing, but of course I have to. And I understand that and intellectually understand that, but it's hard to emotionally understand that.
For months, public health officials have reiterated the need for social distancing, avoiding crowds, and wearing masks to slow the spread of COVID-19. And yet, key metrics like hospitalizations and case counts are trending in the wrong direction. Dr. Philip Wong is the director of Dallas County Health and Human Services. He says people are not taking safety measures as seriously as pandemic fatigue sets in.
We just have to be vigilant through this. And we can't let up because that's what we're seeing. A lot of people are relaxing. So we're seeing a lot of cases, a lot of spread happening.
Wong says mixed messages from local and state leaders are also making compliance harder. Texas Governor Greg Abbott has said he will not issue another statewide lockdown despite climbing cases. Meanwhile, Dallas County's COVID-19 risk level is still in the red zone. That means there's a high risk of transmission, and residents are encouraged to stay home. Wong says health officials are trying to stress the science as safety measures become increasingly politicized.
That's where we did have to sort of pivot. You know, the philosophy is just because you can doesn't mean you should. And so even though these things then were being opened up from the state level, we are just providing our local guidance. This is not what the science is recommending.
Wong knows long-term isolation is taking a toll on mental health. Symptoms of anxiety and depression are widespread among Americans during the pandemic.
And this has been a long period of stress, and it's been high intensity stress. It's changing everyone's life. And this is, you know, it's understandable why people are getting tired of it. We're all getting tired of it. I'm getting tired of it.
Wong encourages people to get outside, practice self-care, and find safe ways to connect with others. And he's hopeful. He says promising news about vaccine trials shows there is light at the end of the tunnel. But Wong says it's not time to ease up on precautions just yet. Many new infections in Dallas County have been tied to small gatherings, like birthday parties, weddings, and get-togethers at bars and restaurants.
They just think, oh, I'm just going to go to this one party, or I'm just going to do this one thing. And that's where, you know, you get the spread. You have to be vigilant. You just have to be doing this all the time.
Wong says there will be more family gatherings and holiday celebrations in the years to come. But the choices made this year could have lasting consequences. I'm Saida Hassan in Dallas.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Michael Marks is in for Wells Dunbar, and he's monitoring social media today. Hello there, Michael.
Hey, David. Let me put this to you. For me, I don't know if this is the case for you, but for me, in my opinion, few better feelings than getting someone a gift that really hits, really resonates, something that they're going to get a lot of use out of, always wanted, really special.
Then, you know, you tears could always make you feel like you've hit ground zero, right?
I mean,
I used to love to try to get my mom. It was like, okay, now if the waterworks come, I know I've hit this spot, you know?
You can tell instantly whether you have hit a home run or not. I mean, because we've all done it.
Maybe she hated the gift. I don't know. I mean, still, usually.
Would have been a terrific actress, perhaps. But I mean, we've maybe all exaggerated a bit. But I bring this up because right now there is on the market a great one-of-a-kind gift for you, I think.
Oh, for me? Personally,
for you,
or just generally?
Personally. No. You as in David Brown. I may have to correct me if I'm wrong.
I am all ears, man. I'm all ears.
So yesterday, former U.S. Senate candidate MJ Hager tweeted that she has the perfect Christmas present for the Harley fan and political junkie in your life. It is the Harley that Hager rode in campaign ads in her attempt to unseat Republican Senator John Cornyn. This can be yours. It's a 2016 Harley Davidson Iron 883. I don't know what that means. I guess that's a
Sportster for those of you who are riders out there. Actually, in my humble opinion, I think it's one of the coolest Hondas because it's small, compact. Yeah, it's loud, but it's really it's got that Harley sticker on the side. So anyway, it's a cool ride. So she's auctioning her Harley. What's she doing here?
That is correct. Auctioning it off currently on eBay. No bids yet, David. The auction starts at $7,999. Only 1,700 miles on it.
1,700 miles. What year is it? What year is it? Does it say?
It's a 2016.
I think that's a fair price, actually. Yeah.
Well, that's what you, Lord Aaron, on Twitter says. $8,000 for the mileage in the year. That's not a bad deal. Some questions about where the money from the sale goes. Twitter user Supermills asks on Twitter, how does the campaign liquidation thing work? If you sell a car or a bus or a Harley bought by the campaign, who gets the money? The eBay posting does not address where the proceeds from this particular sale would go. But, you know, like I said, David, maybe a Christmas present for yourself if you're feeling particularly generous. I don't know.
I think I'm covered on the two-wheel front. But I know that we have a director who also is a rider.
That's true.
Right? I mean, you know who we're talking about there, Leah Scarpelli.
We could get
a triumph person, though, by and large. I'm not sure she's ready to do the Harley thing. She likes the Brit bikes.
I definitely know what you're talking about.
I'm not sure. You may be the only one who knows where. And anyway, no, that's a very interesting story, and it will be interesting to see what that ultimately sells for and whether. Where that money goes to. Hey, listen, we're out of time for the big broadcast. Keep us up to date with what's going on in your part of Texas by reaching out to us, won't you? Texas Standard is where you'll find us on the internets. We're going to be back here tomorrow. We hope you will join us. Till then, I'm David Brown wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family. Would your company or organization like to be a sponsor as well? Contact your local station for opportunities within your community. For statewide sponsorships, visit TexasPublicMediaNetwork.com.